Welcome to The Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. On this episode, we'll be discussing our weekly news roundup, a listener email asking us to choose an actor whose work we could remove forever. And our topic this week, can TV series finales ever truly live up to fan expectations? And stick around, because at the end, we're going to discuss the Game of Thrones premiere and tempt you with a new podcast offering. Let's get on with the show. Peterson, joining me today, my fellow host, John Davenport.
Hey, Aaron, how are you doing today?
Great, not as good as you. You're doing cool stuff, but we'll talk about that a little later. Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
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 What's new?
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hello, governor.
Hello, governor.
We've lost six people already. All right, guys, I want to jump into this because I have a book report to read to you, if you're interested.
I'm here for it. I know one thing is like I'm really excited
We've been doing this news thing a little differently. We've been doing like a roundup where we just do it all at once, and then we just talk about whatever really stuck out to us. And nobody commented that they didn't like it, so we're going to keep doing it that way.
Nobody really commented that they did either, though.
I did.
Well, that's all that matters.
I just told you. I like it.
Well, you know, if you don't hear negative things, then that means everything's positive.
Absolutely.
Sure.
All right, so here we go. Brrrrum. A lot of things happened over the course of this past week. Veronica Mars announced the revival series will release all 8 episodes on Hulu on July 26th. Amanda squeed for the universe.
Woo!
Disney had their Star Wars celebration and announced quite a bit. We'll break it up a little bit. Including Disney Plus hits this fall at $6.99 a month because they're like, screw you, Netflix. And will be ad-free, fully supported by subscription fees. By the way, Netflix lost $8 billion in shares the following day, so you know people were pretty impressed, especially investors. The display is pretty sleek if you haven't seen it. And they did also say The Mandalorian, which is their first new Star Wars show, will debut on a weekly basis this fall. One episode at a time, no binge option. Other updates, Manifest was renewed for season 2, Blue Bloods earned season 10, and a bunch of other renewals this past week. They are working on a sequel to Alicia Vikander's Tomb Raider reboot, so we're getting a part 2 to that, which is pretty interesting since I didn't think it was a huge hit, but it did pretty well.
So good, though.
Okay. Well, I think the opinion is diverse on that one.
It is, yeah.
All right, Netflix is creating its own magazine. Because anybody actually reads those. The Game of Thrones Season 8 premiere broke records again to the tunes of tens of millions of viewers. Avengers directors Joe and Anthony Russo are heading to MGM to oversee a slate of remakes of their classic films, because we don't have enough of those. Speaking of remakes, The Last of the Mohicans is being fitted for television. Ada Kroll and Michael Green were the showrunners responsible for getting Why the Last Man picked up for a series at FX. You guys remember that? But they also just parted ways over creative differences. So they're gone. That's not boding well for that show, but we'll see what happens. Sony announced a PlayStation 5 is coming soon.
Oh.
And we'll be backwards compatible and have legitimate 4K. And then Microsoft, like hours later, immediately announced a diskless version of their Xbox One. So
the Xbox One.
But without a disc.
So really, I'm losing out on this.
Yeah, it's less than the PlayStation 5 is what I'm saying.
Well, it's also less than their original Xbox One.
Yeah, they're like, you don't get a disc, but you save money. Yeah, but I don't get that. Okay, nerds. And the last of the Disney news, there will be a Hawkeye TV series. So apparently every Marvel hero will get their own series someday, eventually. Even if there's like a Marvel butler, I'm sure he'll get one too. I don't know. And then finally, they unveiled the first trailer for Star Wars Episode 9, which featured a very familiar laugh. Weirdly, it was Mark Hamill's The Joker. I don't know what that meant, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of weird.
Whew, that is a lot of stuff. Johnny, what do you think? Is anything out of all of that stand out to you as something that really merits a discussion?
I'm really disappointed that Netflix took a hit because Disney just announced something for $6.99. Okay, well, that's cute, but... more importantly, this laugh at the end of the Star Wars trailer was the one thing that really piqued my interest, which the rest of it was kind of like the only cool moments were things that we've already experienced before. So here we are again.
Yeah. Skip ahead 2 minutes if you haven't watched the trailer. If you're three people that haven't watched the trailer, well,
I'm one of three.
Leave for 2 minutes because we're about to discuss. The laugh at the end is Emperor Palpatine.
Right.
Oh.
Ooh, drama. John, what are you, do you have a thought? Like, how could he even possibly be there? Last time we saw, he was getting chucked down a radiator vent or something. I don't know. He was getting shocked. Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, let's just pull from my knowledge from, like, the extended universe in the books.
Clone. I thought that doesn't count.
No, I'm just saying, like, the idea is that if they were going to pull from ideas from anywhere, there's an idea that they can pull from there, which is clone.
Okay, so it's a possibility that the Emperor was cloned.
Possible, yeah. I mean, that's one of the stories dealt with the same sort of idea, which a long-thought dead Sith Lord, they came back, and he came back kind of good, but it turned out to be the reason why he was kind of good was because he was a clone, and then he went evil anyways.
I don't know. Okay, so everybody that I say this to starts to hate me and say that I'm obviously a Star Wars hater because I can have any legitimate criticism. You cannot critique Star Wars. It's against the rules, apparently. The thing that bothers me with the new trailer is that every cool aspect to it, minus, I guess, the moment where she jumps is pretty neat. But outside of that, every thrill I got from watching the Episode 9 trailer came from nostalgia of the old cast, not from anything to do with the new cast. And I feel like they already did that with Force Awakens. So while everybody's squeeing nonstop, I thought it was fine, but I did not get the same feeling that I feel like everybody else did. And I feel like that makes me, I don't know, negative Nelly is what I'm being told, because I'm not getting as excited as I'm required by law, by Star Wars law. Thoughts on this? I mean, does anybody understand? Do you understand what I'm saying, though? I mean, the beats, the excitement, the joy is all from reminding you of the previous trilogy, not from this trilogy.
That's unfortunate. I wonder if the people who are really excited about this trailer, though, are feeling it on the other spectrum where they are getting joy and excitement from these new characters, the new casting that we have with this this iteration of Star Wars. Iteration isn't the right word, but you get what I'm saying. This extended branch of the Star Wars universe. It's possible that gets them excited, even though it hasn't gotten you excited. Maybe it's just...
They don't really show that here, though. Oh. All they show,
I did see the jump.
You got
There's
Palpatine, you got Billy Dee, you got Leia, you got...
A Death Star that's crashed on a planet.
Death Star's crashed on a planet. Everything is like the previous trilogy. It's not this trilogy. I want to be excited about what's coming with these guys.
Well, not only that, but the imagery is something they pulled from Force Awakens, where before it was a crashed Star Destroyer, now it's a crashed Death Star. Like, they can't build any new imagery out of this whole thing. It's kind of disappointing. I think you're absolutely right. The fact that we don't have more moments reflecting on the fact that we have Finn and
Rey.
Right. I mean, yeah, these characters are supposed to be having great moments and making us want to come back to them. But no, they're using Leia, Billy Dee back in the Millennium Falcon again. Like, these things are the more exciting aspects. Yet we should be more excited for the new characters that are doing things.
That's all I'm saying. I don't mean in a negative. It looks like a cool Star Wars movie. I have no problem with the movie. I'm excited as a Star Wars fan. And yes, I am a fan. I am excited to see the movie, but not by the trailer. The trailer didn't do anything to wow me because it just felt like, okay, you're pulling on. I almost feel a little bit as though they are trying to make up for The Last Jedi, or the reaction from a lot of people to The Last Jedi, even though I don't feel that way. I feel like that's a good movie. Not great, but it's good. And they got so much backlash. They're just trying to go back to what did work for Force Awakens, what got people excited for that one.
But I think at the same time, they need to recognize that although we had a lot of fun with The Force Awakens, we gave a lot of leniency for that one being so nostalgic because we were expecting it as like the first entry into this trilogy to be like, oh, this, we just need to wet our toes in it. And of course, they're going to have tiebacks to the original. And, you know, we're going to feel that nostalgia. But now we're so far into this that we should have something beyond that nostalgia value and our factor. And I think that's where you're right, where they're relying too heavily. They're going backwards now when they should be going forwards. Now, I haven't seen the trailer. I've only seen pieces of it. So
how
I guess,
could you avoid it?
Do you want to know why? I've rewatched the Veronica Mars trailer so many times.
Yeah, they released the same day, by the way.
Half an hour apart.
Bad plan on Veronica Mars's part.
Yeah. So that's why I just didn't have a chance. I was, you know, going through our...
There's nothing there. I mean, she's just sitting at a desk and then the words are popping up. That's literally all that happens.
You hear her voiceover. You get to see her taser again. There's a lot of great things that are happening.
I can watch The Good Place.
Well, sure, that's fair. But, you know, as somebody who has been waiting for something like this to happen with Veronica Mars again for so long, I was so invested in that I literally didn't even think about the Star Wars trailer for 2 days. And then I saw it on Twitter and I didn't watch it. But then I started seeing GIFs and I was like, oh, that's cute. Like, I saw the part where she jumps in the air and she like rolls around.
That part's pretty awesome.
That was
really
cool.
Yeah, that was a pretty badass moment.
And I saw a picture.
But that's the only stuff with the new cast where I'm like, OK, you showed me you get. What's his name? Vader wannabe.
Kylo.
Yeah, you get Kylo apparently doing the same scene from The Force Awakens. That's about it.
Do you also... Okay, so to give them some credit here, maybe they're not showing us as much with the new cast because they want to get you excited for the movie but not really show you the important stuff that's going to be new and fresh.
It's possible, but I firmly believe this is in response to the lackluster Solo performance and The Last Jedi reaction, which critics loved and audiences apparently didn't love as much. And there's such a polar fight going on between fans that loved and hated that movie. It's weird because I'm like, the movie is not worth this kind of...
There's like a huge divide between Star Wars fans who are all Rogue One and all Last Jedi, and they just fight each other. And they're like, nah, Rogue One sucked. And then they're like, no, Last Jedi sucked. Don't argue with me.
Why are any of them fighting? I mean, they're both fine.
It's all Star Wars, my dude. Come on.
I mean, none of those people need to be fighting each other. They're all wheezy. Their breathalyzers are probably on empty. Yes. I mean, it's just not worth it.
All that news besides the Star Wars, which I think we've talked plenty about, I keep wanting to call it midichlorian, the Mandalorian, it surprised me that they are going to do the once a week thing. But on the same token, I believe I'm at the point where there's so much TV, I want more shows to do that so I have more time to catch up.
Yes, I actually respect their decision on this because we don't have a whole lot of shows that are doing this anymore. All we have are binge content, and, you know, tying back to Veronica Mars, they're releasing all at once. I wish they would have done the same thing. So it's cool that one show is doing it and all kind of, they're not in the same network, but, you know, Disney owns everything in the world. So it's
true.
It is interesting that
they're coming,
making weird choices, you know?
Yeah, well, as far as The Mandalorian goes, I was excited about the concept of the show because I thought it was going to take place during the time period of which the Mandalorians were a real thing. But as I understand it, it's actually going to be taking place like somewhere after Solo.
Yeah, I really thought it was going to be a different time period, an earlier time period.
Wait, it's not going to be earlier?
No, it's not. And that's really kind of disappointing because...
I could have swore it was earlier. Are you sure about that, John? I want to make sure we're not talking out of turn here.
So the character that they brought up, that Paul Bettany played in Solo, they have another actor playing him older in the Mandalorian.
Okay.
So that's like that's my tip off that it happens after Solo. If that character is still here, but we have the guy who does the documentaries who's really scary, Werner Warthog.
It's really scary.
Well, yeah, he's scary.
And follows a lone gunfighter in the outer reaches of the galaxy, far from the authority of the New Republic. Is the New Republic before?
New Republic is after Return of the Jedi.
Okay, so it's after Return of the Jedi then?
Yeah.
Okay, and you wanted it to be before that? You wanted it to be a long, long time ago, even further in a galaxy far, far away? Is that what you wanted?
Yeah. I really wanted it to be further away because I wanted it to be something, or maybe not a long, long time ago. It is a long time ago still. Yeah, I wanted it to be even a longer time ago and in a galaxy further away where the Mandalorians were a thing. Because in the lore of Star Wars, as far as what we know, the only reason why we have Boba Fett running around in that armor is because he found the armor. So now we're going to have somebody else who finds the armor and he's running around.
Gotcha. The answer is probably yes.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, but we'll find out.
It's like they're saying, okay, well, we don't want to use Boba Fett because maybe we want to use him for something else later on, which Just leave him inside the stupid Sarlacc pit. Just do that. We don't need more Boba Fett. If we're going to do Mandalorian, let him be somebody cooler.
So bitter about the Fett, man.
He is.
But on the plus side, we're getting a Tomb Raider sequel. And now that they don't have to do that origin story, I think that could be really, really cool. If they wanted to.
Really liked the first one.
I thought the Dora Explorer movie was the sequel.
I see what you did there. The one where it's inappropriately a little too... She needs to be younger.
She's still in high school.
I don't know why. Maybe it's how it's shot or something, but it just feels like they're I don't like it. I just feel wrong.
That's weird.
That sounds like a you problem.
I think it's a John problem too. I think it's it's just a problem.
It's a pervert problem. Am I the only one who is actually kind of excited about this Netflix magazine though?
Yes.
Because
literally people that work at Netflix don't understand.
Well, it's supposed to, you know, showcase what they have coming up throughout the year. And to me, it's kind of like this is another strand of Entertainment Weekly magazines.
How many people read them?
Hearing about it, I have now been considering, okay, maybe I'll get that subscription because they were talking about it being digital. So you don't have to get the paper copy. Of course, I would prefer the paper copy because there's all of the cool stuff.
I've been considering buying a jet plane for most of my life, and I don't have one.
You don't have the ability.
Well, she also needs a paper copy so that she can continue to cut out all the letters and write those letters, you know, use the ransom letters notes that she cuts out as ransom notes.
And to send to the boys I like.
Right.
Oh, how creepy is that? I love you. Send $200,000 if you ever want to see your puppy again. $200,000 if you ever want to see your puppy again.
I was like, don't minimize how much my value is here.
Did you say worth it?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think we need to weigh the value of puppies. All right. I think that's enough on news. Since it ended up being mostly Star Wars, people are like, I'm sick of Star Wars. Well, get used to it because it's going to be the rest of the year.
I don't know if they noticed, but we're kind of sick of Star Wars too.
I just want it to be new and exciting. But they're taking a break. They said they're taking a break on Star Wars movies for a while after this.
It's about time.
Yeah, if Solo did anything right for us.
I do think they need to take a breather and refocus. Although right. I would watch an Ewan McGregor.
Oh, who wouldn't?
I would. I would watch.
Totally.
Yeah. They would have a lot of income.
Does Obi-Wan Kenobi, like the later years or something? I don't know.
In his retirement community.
Having Obi-Wan Kenobi running around being grouchy and it's Ewan McGregor doing it. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll watch it.
I'm in. Okay. So we got an email from a listener, Ruben McDade. And he says, if you had the chance to eradicate all of one actor/actress's work in movies, who would it be and why? For example, if you chose Eddie Murphy, all of his stand-up stays, just all of his movies go. And he said, he followed up, my choice would always get a lot of hate, but it's Ben Stiller. I have never enjoyed a Ben Stiller movie enough that I couldn't live without it. I find his acting wooden and unfunny, just my opinion. Hope this gets an interesting response. Ruben, I just want to tell you, that's a big no, because that would mean we would lose Happy Gilmore, and I can't have that.
Yeah, none of us can have that.
Okay.
Wait, I'm trying to remember him in Happy Gilmore, and why can't I remember him in Happy Gilmore?
He was the nurse's aide. He was the one at the retirement
home. He was!
Yeah! Welcome to... When did you learn about Ben Stiller and Happy Gilmore? Today, years old?
I forgot that he was the nurse. I was like, I was looking at every other part of that cast except for the nurse.
I knew something John didn't know. All right, Amanda. So if you could eradicate the world from one actor, actress's work in movies, who would it be and why? And I have a feeling I'm going to know who this is.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think it's going to be?
Tom Cruise.
I don't know. You're going to get probably angry when you say his name because you always seem to get angry when you say his name.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Oh,
you're wrong.
Thank God, because I'm not losing Tropic Thunder, okay?
I would not do that.
What do you mean, you people?
I would not do that because even though... See, here's my thing. Now, this is just on a little tangent.
Are you thinking about everybody else?
No.
If you're going to go on a tangent about if you lost him, it would be a stunt actor that we would definitely need. We don't need to have this tangent.
No. He is a great stunt man.
Anyway!
But he's just an overrated actor. That doesn't mean I don't think that he's enjoyable to watch for people. He has some decent movies. I just think they would be better without him. So I choose Kristen Stewart.
Wait, all of Tom Cruise's movies would be better without Tom Cruise.
Yes.
So weird. Who? Kristen Stewart, huh?
Yes. I don't need her. I don't need her movies. There's been like one movie that I was like, oh, I kind of like that. And that was American Ultra. Otherwise,
that was a good movie. That was a good flick.
But I also can live without it if that means I never have to see another Twilight movie again. Now, the first one, I was kind of, for like some weird reason, I think it's because I had read the book and I had expectations. I was sort of okay with the first movie, even though it was like the worst one of the entire franchise. But I'm really okay never having her mediocre acting ever happen again, because I can act better than her. My drama can somehow be better than hers. And yet she's making millions. She's making out with hot guys.
I saw that she's part of the new
girls.
Charlie's Angels.
And that's why I decided to choose her.
You want to make Charlie's Angels go away?
I want to make the remake go away with her in it.
This is such an angry topic, Ruben. Thanks, Ruben.
Do not like her as an actress. I think she's fine. I've seen her on SNL and she seems a little bit better there.
Look, I will stop you there. Well, I guess I'm adding to what you already said. She was really funny on Saturday Night Live. I was surprised. I'm like, you need to do more comedies, because I legitimately found her charming. And I will say, in The Huntsman?
Yeah.
The Huntsman. She's very good in The Huntsman.
She's pretty good.
Nope. I'm going with she's very good. I really enjoyed her in the first one. Yeah, the first one. I thought she was an asset to that movie.
Hmm. Well, anyway, we can still live without her in movies.
Well,
not like her actual life. I don't want her life to end. Just
I certainly hope not.
Her
that
career.
That would be very cruel, Ruben. Thanks for bringing that.
Or if she just sticks around on SNL, because that was enjoyable. But again, it's just movies, not the rest of it. So she could all of her SNL work would still be there.
Hmm.
Would that count as stand-up? I don't think Saturday Night Live is stand-up.
No, the reason he gave that example is because it's just movies.
Fine.
SNL isn't a movie.
She can join the cast of Saturday Night Live or be a comedy on television or something. There you go. All right, well, my pick, I am going to go to exactly what everyone thinks I'm going to pick, and that's Miles Teller.
No.
Bye.
No.
There's not a single movie I can not live without. Not a single one.
There was one that he was just
Solid
in
choice.
That was so good.
Oh, which I could live without.
But I don't know that you saw it. Did you?
I'm sure I did. And I thought, wow, he's mediocre.
He wasn't mediocre.
Was it the firefighter movie?
Yes.
Or the one where he was a soldier?
The firefighter movie.
And he was fine in that one. But once again, mediocre.
Also, Whiplash?
I could live without Whiplash.
No, I'm not okay with that.
Pretty sure J.K. Simmons would have been fine in something else. He would have gotten an Oscar eventually.
Like Veronica Mars.
Yep. So there's my pick, Ruben. It's going to be Miles Teller. And it's not because I think he's horrible. I just think he's not good. So goodbye to your glorious mediocrity, buddy.
Him and Kristen Stewart can leave together.
I would rather have Kristen Stewart.
Well, yikes. You know what? Joining the two of them is going to be Seth Rogen.
No!
What?
Get out of here!
Yeah, I wanted to pull this card way before the movie that's coming out.
Long Shot,
which was so good.
Which was great.
Right. So I'm pulling this card now before I see this movie, because I will admit, there's a chance with that movie he can actually win me back over. But prior to that movie, there is not a single thing that I can't live without when it comes to him.
Wait, let me ask. Does this include movies he's produced/written? I guess he didn't say. He said starring, right?
He said an actor or actress. That would mean their work that they've been.
Because he's been behind a lot of really.
He has produced some legit stuff.
When he was in Superbad, that means Superbad goes away. Pineapple Express goes away.
Basically, every movie that has James Franco in it is gone.
Oh, look at that. I get a twofer.
Hey, you get out of here with that. I like that, man.
I get a twofer.
No, you can't.
John wins on so many counts.
I never thought I would say this. I never thought I would defend Seth Rogen so much, but I really think that he's creatively talented, and I can't have you take that away from me as both an actor and also a writer producer. Except for
I think he's a great writer. I think he is a great writer. Actor, he's
enjoyable. He's super entertaining.
I didn't say he wasn't enjoyable, but let's go easy on. He's a good actor.
He is good.
He's great at playing Seth Rogen.
I mean, that's fine. Not necessarily because he's had a couple different types of roles. They just happen to revolve around comedy.
Yeah. Heavily dramatic roles that you can recite off the top of your head because they were so wonderful?
I can tell you them.
Yeah, if you have IMDb in front of you and you have a few minutes.
Catherine Heigl movie and then Zach and Mary Make a Porno. Like, there's a lot of good movies that he was in.
All Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
Being Seth Rogen.
So, you know what?
I'm not making John's point. I'm just saying...
It sounds an awful lot like you're giving me my argument.
No, because
I'm fine. Because the less I have to argue, the better off we are.
I enjoy all of these movies. I'm not knocking any of the movies. I'm just
saying. Except for Sausage Party.
That's an awful movie.
That movie should just not be in existence.
But he's not acting in it. He's voice acting. Does that count?
That still counts.
I don't know what the rules are on this thing. It's just the made up thing. So
what? Don't offend Ruben like that.
I'm sorry, Ruben.
Ruben's better than that. Damn you.
Good question. Kind of negative, though.
Not negative. It was fun.
Who would be the one actor, if they wiped everybody else out, who's the one actor that whose work has to remain?
Oh, God. Like, you can't choose that. Tom Hanks?
I was just about to say Tom Hanks.
I couldn't live without Tom Hanks movies.
I can concede that. Yeah. Tom Hanks is probably the one actor. Okay, we unanimous. That was easy.
Done. Look at, this is the first time we've all agreed on something.
He's got a really exceptional body of work. You know, a lot of actors are great in what they do, but he's got a great body of work.
He is so versatile as an actor. Oh my God. He's so good.
All right, cool.
Second.
Or thirded. Our show is independently funded. Oh, I should mention, please remember to always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com. And you can join our Facebook group where we always put our topic in each week. The Hollywood Outsider. We're also on Twitter at @BuyPopcorn. Patreon. Our show is independently funded. Therefore, all of the expenses come from our own pockets. And patreon.com. That's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider helps fans support the favorite podcast. If you just want to support the show, $1 a month is greatly appreciated. At $3, we have a monthly podcast called Bad Movie Night. Then at $5, you get Hollywood Outsider Plus. That's what we're calling it.
Ho Plus.
Yeah. Ho Plus. Our bonus monthly episode. And as you go up, there are more perks. If you're a Game of Thrones fan, we're actually doing a Patreon-exclusive companion podcast for the final season of the show, which you will get a sample of at the end of this one. So after this sneak peek, the weekly episodes will only be available to Patreon supporters. That's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider.
It is important to note that...
This is John Davenport's baby,
this
by the
is,
way.
Yeah. John decided to come up with this idea, whipped it together.
And you're talking for him. This is John's baby. He can speak.
Well, I was also going to say Scott's part of it.
To give everyone an idea of what I put together for the Patreon people, is it's going to be the Hollywood Outsider half hour power hour. What I wanted to do is create something where we had a good group of people sit down and... like cram in as much of a show of television and have a great time talking about it. Some of it's light, some of it's heavy, but the bottom line is to have a great fun conversation. And that's something easy and small and you can digest really quickly. And that's what we're throwing together. Right now, we're going to do it for Game of Thrones. We'll probably do it for Stranger Things. And then as time goes on, we'll do more and more shows, probably some rewatches here and there, and see if we can either A, find a solid cast to stick with it, or rotate people in and out just to have a good amount of voices sharing a good time.
Okay, and that's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. So check that out, and thank you everybody who already currently support. I don't know what I was just going to make an owl. Thank you to everybody who does. I don't know what I'm saying anymore.
Are you drunk?
I feel like it. But all right, now we go to spoiler-free reviews, and there's just one this week, and that's Hellboy.
Aaron did us all a favor, apparently, and took a bullet and went and saw Hellboy. Based on the graphic novels by Mike Mignola, Hellboy, caught between two worlds, is supernatural and human, battles with ancient sorcerers bent on revenge. This is directed by Neil Marshall, stars David Harbour as Hellboy and Ian McShane. So, Aaron, Neil Marshall, he's been around for a while. He's done a whole lot of great genre television and movies. The reviews for Hellboy aren't great. What do you think happened?
Well, I mean, I read it was a cluster of... producers clashing with director Neil Marshall. I mean, his cinematographer was fired, and there's a whole lot of things behind the scenes. Apparently, that happened. It doesn't matter to me. I don't get caught up in that because it doesn't matter what happened behind. It happens what I see in front. What I see in front looks like everything I heard happen behind. Just this big cluster of ideas and clashes of concepts, and it just feels like. Nobody really had 100% idea of what they wanted to do, and they couldn't nobody had a distinct vision, so it was kind of all over the place. It's not like Del Toro's, which I'm not on that bandwagon. I don't think those are the greatest movies ever. I don't think Del Toro knocked it out of the park. I think he did a decent job with that material. It's a hard character to get. It's a hard character to make click. And here it feels like partly they don't even understand the character they're dealing with sometimes, but it is closer to the comics. It just is, it's not a better movie.
That's a real shame. Mm-hmm. So one of the other things people railed against when they made this announcement for this reboot was they recast Hellboy, and they used David Harbour for it, which a lot of people love David Harbour from Stranger Things. What do you think, him or Ron Perlman? Like, is there a difference?
Well, that's not fair, though.
No, it's not fair.
No, it's not. David Harbour does an absolutely fine job. He's very good at the role. I have no problem. If he would have been in Del Toro's movie years ago, he would have been perfectly cast. Ron Perlman is not the only guy in the whole wide world that can play Hellboy. With that caveat, he does sound an awful lot like Ron Perlman. So it's kind of hard to understand why they even bothered to recast. You want to reboot? You want somebody younger? Okay, I get it. But there's so much makeup. If you needed to replace him down the road, I mean, would it really be that big a deal? So I don't get it. But Harbour isn't the problem at all at the movie. He's the best thing about Hellboy.
Okay, great. So what's your final score?
If $10 is the full price of admission, I'm going to give it $4.50.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's not good. And it's not awful. It's not as bad as Pet Sematary. It's just
almost as bad as Pet Sematary. It's like 50 cents away.
That's an important 50 cents.
Yeah, but that 50 cents is what you would spend to rent it on demand.
Well, a lot of that has to do with special effects and stuff, too. I mean, the special effects are awful. They're not awful, but they're not good for a movie of supposedly this caliber. $50 million, it reminds me a lot of Escape from L.A. I'm like, why do you have these kind of effects on a movie like this? It doesn't make any sense. There's floaty head things, and it looks dumb, and $4.50. And that's given it some credence, I think. But it's not awful. I mean, it could have been better. It's, you know what? Someday, we're going to be flipping through TNT, John. It's going to pop up, and we'll watch the whole thing, because it's one of those movies. It's not awful, but you're going to be too lazy to change the channel if it comes on.
I like those movies.
What a selling point. It's not a good movie, but it's also one
that's
of those.
That's all I got. What do you want me to do? Make a better flick. I'll sell it better. Oh, I feel like it's been a couple weeks in a row where we've just had some lackadaisical flicks. Thank God for Shazam.
Shazam is so good.
I went and saw that again.
All right, new releases. What do we have? Mana, Curse of La Llorona is coming out finally.
No, La Llorona.
Yeah. That's what I said.
No, it's not.
I said it with a honky accent.
No, you didn't.
In 1970s Los Angeles, the legendary ghost La Llorona, I don't know how to say it like Johnny.
La Llorona.
What is it?
Llorona.
Llorona?
So it's La.
La.
Llorona. So we start it with a Y instead of the L.
Llorona.
There you go.
Is stalking the night and the children. Ignoring the eerie warning of a troubled mother, a social worker and her kids are drawn into a frightening supernatural realm. Their only hope is surviving La Yara...
Oh, for God's sake, we just did this.
Ma Llorona.
Her deadly wrath is a disillusioned priest who practices mysticism to keep evil at bay. It's directed by Michael Chavez, who did The Maiden and Conjuring 3. Not really some selling points, but it stars Linda Cardellini, Patricia Velasquez, I almost had that right, and Marisan Ramirez. There's too many names that I can't pronounce.
Wow. Okay, so family, this is a movie that some would say is uproarious, sheer joy, and that Taylor Schilling is a revelation.
Was that you?
Yeah, it was. It's on the poster. Go check it out. Hollywood Outsider. And that's because Taylor Schilling stars as Kate Stone, a career-focused woman whose brash attitude keeps relationships at arm's length, making her an outcast in her own right. When her estranged brother calls asking her to babysit her tween niece Maddie, Kate reluctantly agrees to help. But babysitting overnight unexpectedly turns into a week, and Kate's life spins into a chaos. As Maddie reveals stories of being bullied and wanting to run away and be a juggalo, the two form a unique bond. For me, I would call this movie Uncle Buck for 2019. I did see it at South by Southwest. That is my review on top of the poster. Hey, Hollywood Outsider. And it is that good. It's, if you can find it, right now it's limited. If you can find it, that's a great, great comedy.
And he was talking it up before he got on the poster, too.
That's true.
Well, yeah, they took my quote and put it on the poster. So therefore, I said it before that.
Well, no, I understand that.
It would be really weird if the poster came out and I hadn't said those words yet. But
where's my check? Where's my check?
They tell you what to put in your review. We're going to need you to use this line.
All right. So Aaron also saw this at South by last year. This is Fast Color. A woman is forced to go on the run when her superhuman abilities are discovered. Years after having abandoned her family, the only place she has left to hide is home. This is directed by Julia Hart. This is written by Julia Hart and Jordan Horowitz and stars... I'm not even... No, I'm sorry. This woman... that's not even a real name. Gugu Mbatha-Raw?
Yeah.
And Lorraine Toussaint.
That's her name. Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
Mbatha-Raw?
Yes.
Right. I was just making sure it's Gugu.
It sounds like the power of the sun god. I think we just summoned the mummy.
I'm pretty sure we'd be able to rip somebody's heart out after saying her name four times.
Anyway, it's a really good movie, and it's a different twist on superhero flicks. So I would definitely recommend that if you can find it, too.
Well, on Netflix, we have Someone Great. Dumped by her long-term boyfriend, a music journalist recruits her two best friends for one last outrageous adventure in New York City before she moves to San Francisco. It has Gina Rodriguez, Brittany Snow, and Rosario Dawson. It's produced by Paul Feig and is directed by Jennifer Caton Robinson, and this is actually her directorial debut from what I can tell.
All right, of those, which is your pick of the week, guys? What do you want to see most of the four?
I think this is going to surprise anyone, but I'm going to go with Someone Great.
Because it's on Netflix and you don't like to leave the house?
Yeah.
Fair.
If I had access to family, I would be watching that one. But I'm probably going to go with the chick flick movie and drink a bottle of wine.
Well, I'm going to, even
like a whole bottle by yourself? That's like four glasses.
I would be drunk by like a glass and a half.
Then why did you say a bottle of wine?
Well, I wasn't going to drink the whole thing. I was just going to like drink. Maybe I was going to drink from the bottle. I don't know. You're asking me too many questions. Maybe I will drink the whole bottle. Sounds, I don't need your judgment.
He's pointing out a problem is what it sounds like. I'm going to watch a movie and drink a whole bottle of wine while I do it.
It'll probably be the first time I've had some wine in like almost a year.
That's what every drunk says.
Right.
That's new. What are all those bottles in the backyard, Jim? All right, well, then we're going to go our From the Outside In topic. TV series finales, do they ever live up to our expectations? Lost, Breaking Bad, Battlestar Galactica, Dexter, Friends, etc. Hit shows have to eventually come to an end. And typically when they do, our expectations are really, really high. We have endured this journey for years. And because of that, we each have a conclusion somewhere in the back of our minds of how everything is supposed to end. Right? I think we all do.
Yes, we do.
I try not to anymore.
Okay, super stud. But when we finally reach that last episode and anticipation has overtaken our own internal logic, how many TV shows actually do end perfectly according to fan expectations? That's what we're going to talk about this week. So here we are, hit shows. They have to eventually come to an end. Typically when they do, like I said, our expectations are really high. But if you're a diehard fan, are we being unreasonable to expect a fantastic conclusion?
Yeah, I'm going to go with yes. We are being unreasonable to expect actually to impose a conclusion on any story that we're watching. Because as much as we've taken ownership of the story, it's not our story being told, right?
Agreed. Yes, absolutely.
No, I don't agree.
It's your story being told?
I'm not saying that, but I don't agree that we don't have some sort of...
I feel like if you disagreed, it is saying that.
No. let me explain my point, okay, before you start making your assumptions here.
I literally responded to what you said.
I think that we do and should expect a fantastic conclusion, and I think that is completely reasonable of us. To determine what that is what's unreasonable for us, because that is the part where we're saying we're overstepping our boundaries as a viewer. But I think to expect the best outcome, whatever that may be, it might be a dark outcome, it might be whatever works best for the show in terms of the story, we have a right to expect that because we've been investing in your storytelling and your job is literally to give us the best possible story and conclusion.
I don't know about literally.
Well, that is their job.
It's their job to tell a story relating to whatever.
And do the best they can.
Does it really have to be the best they can?
Well,
have you seen NCIS? I don't think it has to be.
I kind of like that. Right. But anyway, it's something where we shouldn't impose our beliefs of how it should end on the writers. But I don't think that it's too far-fetched for us to be like, you damn well better give us a good conclusion. Because I've been sticking around with you since day one. I've watched you. I've given you my money. You have a job because this is something that's satisfying so many people.
Well, okay. There's a point, but we'll come back to that. Go ahead, John.
The one to look at the most is actually going to be Lost. So let's take a look at Lost. I love the way Lost ended. There's a lot of people who don't love the way Lost ended because
guilty.
There's a lot of like those misconceptions of what the story was that people have put on that. You know, from the very beginning, people were like, they're in purgatory, da 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 da. And as soon as it started looking like they might actually be in purgatory on that last episode, that's when, like, the fans jumped up and be like, I told you, you guys lied to us, and that's crap. And they totally lost sight of what that story was. So maybe there was a brief moment in which they were in a place that looked like purgatory. I don't agree with that, but that's where, like, that ending, like, the fans had taken over everything so much that that's where it gets lost, so to speak.
I see what you did there. That's where it gets lost.
That was totally by accident. I had no other words left in my head to say, and I'm so mad at myself for choosing that one.
I would argue that's not necessarily the case. I know that the purgatory thing comes up, and yes, they definitely were not in purgatory at the end of that series. They just weren't. I will say that that was the original plan in season one. That was the original plan. I had a writer confirm that to me a couple of years ago, that was the original plan. But because so many fans guessed it, they actually changed the ending. So they did change how that show was going to play out. But what happened at the end of Lost wasn't purgatory. Agreed. That wasn't a lot of people. A lot of people had a legitimate criticism of the ending to that show. And the diehards, like maybe the Johnnies of the world, won't ever let them have it. They will fight until their dying day that they're wrong, and that they just didn't, quote unquote, get it. And I'm sorry, it's just what the show was partly what the diehards seem to say it was. But it was also about the island and the mysteries on the island. And they did half-ass that. And I will argue that to my dying day, because it just gets so frustrating to hear that, no, that's not what this show is about. Well, then why was it on an island? And why was all this crazy stuff happening? It sure wasn't random.
And then you have people like me who started the show after I had seen some of it when it first started, but then I got out of it and then I came back to it to binge it, I think on Netflix. And the time that I got close to the end of the show, there were so many people who were still, it was like, for some reason, there were like, after a couple years after it ended, there were people who, like, out of nowhere decided to, like, come up the hill and was like, have fire, pitchforks and, like, fire to ready to burn down everything because of the ending. And people so angry and, like, vitriol about this ending pushed me away. I still haven't seen the last two episodes of the series, because I don't want to, because at this point I'm like, I don't want to be a part of this, I don't want to have an opinion on it. Y'all ruined me wanting to finish the show.
It still happens,
because nobody can just accept the show for what it is. And I get that there's backstory here where the story wasn't what it originally intended to be, like Aaron just confirmed, and there's a lot of things that people didn't like about it. But then to me it was sort of like, you are mad at the show because it's not what you had in your mind. But at the same time, it's like, well, were the writers just not being their best selves in terms of writing the best story versus writing to their audience? And so I'm just like, you people ruined it for me. I don't care to see the last two episodes now.
And that brings me to the other point. I think it was Amanda you were talking about. I gave you my money, so you guys owe us in a way. Hey, no, I heard you.
I shouldn't.
You spoke. You did a paragraph.
That's not what I meant.
A book report. That is exactly what you said.
No, I was saying that we have been.
I wasn't saying take the mic back.
No, but you're putting words in my mouth. That
Aaron
is not what
has
I meant.
The talkie stick.
Okay, what did you mean? And be succinct.
My point was simply that if you are a writer and that is your job, and we are investing in your creative property, you should be trying for yourself and for your viewers to give the best property possible, the best story possible. You should be doing that out of your own, like, self-worth and like your job.
Okay.
But also as a reward to your audience members for continuously supporting your creative work.
Got that. Now, my argument counterpoint to that would be,
okay,
that yes, we've watched it. Yes, it's a reason why they're still in the air. Yes, 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 all that jive, which I just want to point out, it's not like we're paying them $20 a month to watch their specific show. Regardless, especially when you got network TV, do they really owe us? I mean, it's network TV. We're not paying them anything. We're just watching ads, or we're fast forwarding through ads.
What ads?
Exactly. My argument would be that if you get to the end of a show that a showrunner has been invested in since day one, yes, it's great that the fans were there the whole time, but the ending should be whatever the creators envision, regardless of what fans want.
We're not in disagreement there.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying a lot of people don't. They feel like we're fans. We're invested in this. We want this to go a certain way. I think Dexter's a prime example where they didn't want to go where the audience wanted them to go. Die Hard wanted them to go. And because they went to a different place, it really polarized a lot of their audience. But they felt that was the best course of action for the character. So who... Now, we can see it as maybe it wasn't good. Maybe it wasn't...
It was done horribly.
I have very little problem with
the visual effects in that, in the episode.
Okay, but people don't like how it ended. Terrible. How it ended.
Yeah.
So, is it really fair that they don't have... It's almost, in a way, it's almost as if the audience is taking back creative control of a show that they didn't create. And I get why it happens. I just don't think it's necessarily the right thing to do. You have so many shows where they're ending, and they should end based on what the creators want to see happen, because it's their story. They told it. It's not our story. As much as we might be invested in it, it isn't ours. We don't have any claim to it. They should be able to, when they get to that final round, they should be able to end it however they see fit.
I completely and totally agree. That was my point. My problem with a lot of fandom, and this is one of the reasons why I've sort of over the especially the last 10 years have learned to pull back my adoration for certain things and try to keep more of a measured tone and appreciate it for what I'm seeing, is because when I start getting way too obsessive or way too into something, it's not fair to what the creator is actually doing. So as a creator myself, I know that when I'm putting something together, that's my time, my energy, my effort being put into something. And if somebody comes in and starts telling me where they would have rather have seen it, it's kind of annoying, and it's kind of robs the value of what I put out there. So it's a cool measured way of appreciating it as a way to go for me.
Don't you guys feel like that's a little bit hypocritical though? Because by saying that you should not be able to critique something as film critics right here.
I'm saying you can critique it. There's nothing wrong with critiquing it. But I firmly believe it's just like an author. It's just like Stephen King. He has a reputation for making great books that don't necessarily end that great. And there's truth to that. But it's his story. So if he wants to go off the deep end and he wants to do it a crazy way that doesn't make any sense to us, yes, we can complain about it and we can have banter on the internet and everything else. But I don't think we deserve any other kind of ending than what he wanted, because it should be the purest of endings, which is what the creator intended, if possible, if the creator's still involved. If it's NCIS, I don't even know. It's been on for 47 years. How is it possible they're still there?
Well, we have a really fine line here that I think is being kind of, we're not really balancing it super fair in society, not necessarily us right here, but in society, where people are going beyond criticism and critique of a show, and they're making it, they're coming out, like I said before, with their pitchforks, and they're like,
that's everything now,
damn this show because they didn't do it the way I wanted to, and I'm never going to watch this show again, I'm never going to rewatch it, I'm not going to support these people. Like, those extremist views, I get, you know, us saying no, this
passion is part of everything.
Yeah, that's too much, that's too far. But I also believe that if you were to take away the voice of the audience members and their opinions and their critiques of a show, then we would have mediocre art everywhere, because nobody would ever be able to hear, you know, this is a choice you made, but from a critic's perspective, this was maybe not the best choice to make because of X, Y, and Z. And those criticisms, I think, are extremely valuable to every creative artist. I mean, for example, Johnny, he does art. If he were to have somebody who looks at his art and says, you know what, this is really great, I like this, this, and that, but there's something here that I think if you did this, I don't know anything about like physical art, if you did this better, it might benefit you.
Right. Well, and The concern is there's a difference between criticism and then implying somebody else's intent. So criticism is something that is necessary and needed. It's an important thing, and learning how to give it and receive it are two very important skills. Yes, those are things that people need to learn. However, you go on the internet or you go out in public and you say a certain phrase, whatever that phrase is, and somebody comes up to you and says, well, you intended to say this and not intend to say what you actually said, which you have an actual right to turn around to that person and say, how dare you tell me what my intent is? You don't live in my head and you don't live in my space. You're doing something specific. But when somebody starts imposing their intent upon you, which is what a lot of fans tend to do, is where the problem is.
Right. And I
really like that analogy, by the way. That was very astute.
It was very good. And I'm not disagreeing with you. My point was just that we have a very unbalanced line in society where people don't know how to be critical of something without imposing their view onto that creative artist. But it still needs to be something that happens.
Criticism is very important. People are all critical now. Everybody's a critic.
Yeah, but there's no balance. People don't know how to do it right anymore.
Oh, so now you're critiquing?
Yes. when yours is so extremist that you're saying this is exactly how it should be done because this is how I feel, that's beyond criticism. That's control.
It's an interesting dynamic whenever a show ends because people are so passionate. And some shows create a certain kind of passion, which is almost polarizing. To where you're either all in or just can't handle it. You know what I mean? I think Game of Thrones is an obvious example with that show ending. And Lost is, I still can't believe people are still arguing about it like I can do for the next 25 minutes. It's been how many years? A lot of years since Lost went out the air and people are still arguing about it. Battlestar Galactica. There's a lot of polarizing ones. It's something that I always find fascinating because it's a great aspect to fandom. But it's also one of the most frustrating aspects of fandom. And it happens in all kinds of shows. You know, I do the Blacklist podcast. The fandom is very passionate there. I mean, people are passionate about whatever they love, whatever that show is. They are passionate about aspects of it. So when a show comes to an end, without a doubt, there's always that.
That's not even counting Troy.
Yeah, Troy Hanrahan is way more passionate than most of the fans, unfortunately. And fortunately, it kind of goes both ways, but it's a weird dynamic that when a show comes to an end, everybody has an opinion how it should end. The creator, especially, should have the highest opinion, I would think. I mean, I get, I don't even know where I was going with that point, but I had a point and then I lost it.
This feels like you went on an Amanda tangent.
I kind of feel like I just reacted the entire series of Lost.
Oh my God.
Somewhere strong. And I ended confused, you know?
It's almost like you almost Detective Pikachu'd your way out of this.
I did. All right. So anything more you want to discuss on this whole concept of series finales and TV? I mean, do you guys get real emotional about your TV shows when they end?
There's been TV shows that I've gotten emotional about, both in the positive and the negative. Like, it doesn't happen often, but I can think of like Farscape. Farscape is one that I nearly flipped a table in my house when that show came to an end. Because, and it has everything to do with what they did for the ending, which I mean, no one here is going to watch Farscape, but they like, you know what, just in case they will watch it. They did something like out of left field and completely shocking. All the characters are screaming. I was screaming. I was looking at the TV. They're looking back at me. I got upset. And it was like, I usually keep a measured tone, and that wasn't happening that day.
And this is how Johnny entered therapy.
Yes. Sure, out me like that. Thanks.
Are you passionate, Amanda, about your...
I mean, what am I not passionate about? But I am emotional.
That's true. Like, half his episode, you sound angry.
Well, it's not angry. It's just I have, like, very distinct opinions on things.
That's what anger is.
No, it's not. I'm not angry.
I have a distinct opinion about this.
I do not sound like Kenny from South Park. Or not Kenny. What's his face?
That's definitely not Kenny.
Not Kenny. Cartman. Cartman, thank you.
Kenny doesn't say anything.
I know. I just said that.
Okay.
You missed it. Anyway, the shows that I become very attached to are ones that elicit an emotional response for me. So for me to not have an emotional response on a show ending would be very kind of confusing if I didn't have some sort of reaction to it, because I tend to fall for those shows that continuously draw that from me and create a bond between me and the characters. And there's some of them that have hit me harder than others, of course, but if I'm passionate about the show and I'm emotionally engaging with it as it goes on, it's going to be hard for me when it does come to an end. But, you know, it happens. Everything comes to an end.
Yeah, I used to. I remember back in, Amanda, you're probably too young, but John, you'll probably remember this. Do you remember like back in the 80s when shows would end? It really, there weren't many that, because back in the 80s, it felt like shows went on forever. So by the time they actually ended, you weren't watching them anymore. For the most part, the vast majority, because you just kind of like get away from them, you know. Oh, it's been eight. I'll just tune in for the finale and catch that. I mean, it was like that with 80s, 90s, like Cheers, Seinfeld, Night Court. I mean, so all the shows I love. The only one I really kept watching the whole time was Moonlighting because I hated myself and I just want to keep punishing myself every week after week after week until the ending, which, hey, the ending's awful. Well, so does most of the last couple seasons, but whatever. And do you remember that, though? Because it was hard to get really passionate about a finale back then. Maybe MASH is probably the exception. I think that's the most watched TV show.
I was
going to
say
ever.
MASH was a pretty powerful one. Yeah. Like that, because that show was, that was one of the first shows to go on TV for as long as it was on TV for. So yeah, that was the one that, like, even at God, I must have been at least in my preteen years when that went off, and or at most in my preteen years when that went off. And I got emotional over that.
Right.
I barely knew what was going on.
And one of the rare shows that actually left still popular, you know, because yeah. Seriously, that's what you don't know about the 80s, man. Shows
well,
when
just because I wasn't alive doesn't mean that I haven't. Well,
I'm making an assumption because you weren't alive. But a lot of times back in the 80s, most of those shows would go on and on and on and on. And they just drag on. They would go on for like 10, 15 years because there's only three channels. So it was the same show. We knew it was on Friday night. We knew it was on Thursday night. We knew it was on when, you know, because it's the same shows week after week. And we'd eventually abandon them. That's when the ratings would decline. And that's when it would finally get canceled. And we'd come back just for that series finale. Nowadays, they're getting to the point where I feel like they understand the base a little bit more, finally. So a lot of, and especially genre-heavy television, which we have more of now because we have more opportunities, they're really focused on bringing it home and ending more on top than they ever used to be. Would you agree with that, John, or am I just crazy?
No, I do agree with that. Supernatural and Arrow are two recent announcements that bring a lot of truth to that. And I would actually expand what you're saying to the extent of there's a lot of genre television that they may be on the bubble or they may not know what their fate is just yet. So they film a season ending that serves just as well as a series finale.
Yeah, I really feel like we're going to get a lot of Netflix shows doing that from now on because they never seem to go more than three seasons anymore.
Well, and if there's no value in it, then they don't see the purpose in it because there's so much other content that you can make. But you also, you have to take into consideration the difference between now and in reference to the 80s. You've had a lot more time to learn the ups and downs and the dynamics of creating a television show and how audiences are going to react to them and what they want
That's
out
true.
Of them, where they didn't have that period of time where they didn't have that data to base everything off of. So they were just kind of like, this is what we're going to do for now. Then they learned from those poor mistakes and said, this is what we can do to really actively engage our audience members and make them want to see the ending versus I can miss a bunch of episodes. And they've also changed the way that they structure TV, too.
Yeah, serialized TV wasn't a thing.
Right. So it was just like you could catch an episode here and then you could skip 14 episodes. I mean, even into the 90s, they did that. And I'm going to use a weird example, but Boy Meets World. This was a huge TV show for teenagers in the 90s. And it's a show that does not follow it does not even follow a continuous process where it's serialized enough that you jump from one day to another 2 weeks later between, you know, the one episode to the next. So nothing was continuous. And with it being that, I don't know, broken in terms of the actual structure of the show, people didn't feel the need to be that connected to it. Whereas now everything is built from one episode to the next. It relies on that information. You have to follow along. So,
yeah, we've talked about the serialized thing. I'm getting tired. I kind of miss the days where I could just pop on a show and I can watch it.
You can now. You just don't like those kinds of shows.
There aren't many that I like that do it.
I know. I'm just saying those shows do exist. They're just not your genre.
I'm finding that if the show is serialized and I'm actually now finding it easier to just watch a couple episodes, walk away.
Yep.
Watch a couple more episodes, walk away.
I will probably give a procedural more episodes than I would a serialized show to win me over. Like, I'll give it a couple to find its footing for a procedural because they're not doing the same kind of show. But a serialized one, if I'm not invested by, I'm getting to where I'm at episode two and I'm like out. I just don't care anymore. Some of them, I can't even make it through the pilot anymore. Umbrella.
You feel like a very sad human these days.
No, man. It's just like, there's so much stuff and everybody, there's so much. And we've talked about that ad nauseum. We don't need to get in that. So we're going to talk about the saddest. Then we're going to get the happy. We're going to bring it back to happy. But your saddest. Talk about the most disappointing series finale you experienced and what it was like for you as a fan. Why it bothered you so much, what it made you emotional about, or however you reacted to it. the worst.
The worst is also happens to be my favorite TV show that's ever existed, and that's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I love the show, but the way that everything changed, the elements that they decided to pursue in the show towards the end did not seem as fitting for what the show was in the beginning. It became something that was not what it originally intended to be. And I felt like in the last season, we were just trying to have some big apocalyptic thing just so they could have a big apocalyptic ending. And I didn't need that. I needed my characters to be who they were before and see their growth and see how their things are different and fight the big bad. And I didn't need it to be the entire city crumbles into the ground and there's a giant hole here now. Like, it felt like it was just done because they wanted a big bang for it. And it wasn't creatively and storytelling wise the best choice, in my opinion, as somebody who watched the show the whole way. There were other avenues that they could have pursued that would have been more beneficial to the type of show that they had created up to that point. So it was very, I mean, I still loved it. Don't get me wrong. Like, I still loved the show and it doesn't take away from that. But watching it, it wasn't as impactful as I imagined it would be. It wasn't something that was like, wow, this was amazing. It had a great end scene.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual where the story ended up going was not, it just wasn't, I don't know how to explain it without making it sound like it wasn't what I wanted from it. It just wasn't what the show started out being. And it went to a completely different place, if that makes sense. You're a Buffy fan. Do you get what I'm saying?
I was underwhelmed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those, that series finale is interesting because if you go back to season 5.
Oh, that's a good,
when it would jump from, was it WP to UPN or WB to UPN or whatever. And they ended it because I don't think they knew for sure they were coming back. So they ended it. And that was a fantastic,
yep,
would have been series finale. If that was the end of the show, I think that's a fantastic way to end it, where Buffy dies saving the world.
Yep.
And it was just, it was magnificent. You know, she, and it was her tombstone. Buffy saved the world a lot. And it was just, it was perfectly charming and funny. Everybody went on, you know, they lived, her memory lived, and she finally got to walk away from it all. And then, you know, season 6 and 7 happened. And I agree, neither one of those seasons were really the show itself. I mean, it almost took, it became a different kind of show.
It was almost like a spinoff.
Yeah, really, I agree with that. I do. And I love that show too. I agree with that. I understand where you're coming from. And I do think emotionally it was very underwhelming.
All of those like additional Slayers and like they're building an army of Slayers.
It took away from Buffy Summers, yes, in a way. And she deserved her own send off. She really, yeah, did. The character.
And I think you have an excellent point in saying that where it went wrong is when they did anticipate an ending and they did make that creative choice. And then they're like, oh, crap, we still got more episodes we got to do. All right, let's figure out how we're going to bring the show back. And it wasn't.
And I'm sure they always had a vision for how they could do it if the show continued. But it just felt like this is a perfect series finale right here.
Yeah.
And I remember when it came back, I almost didn't want it to come back. But we wouldn't have got Once More with Feeling, which was a great episode. So, yeah, you know, you do what you can.
You know, I have to mirror what you guys were saying about that ending. It is, and especially how they ended the series with all those Slayers, it is something that really robbed it of its power. And it felt more like they weren't sure if they were actually canceling the series than it was more of a send-off.
Yeah.
Well, I remember she announced she was leaving the show in Entertainment Weekly that year or something like that before she even told the cast or something.
Well, of all people, I think you would know because you've, yeah, been a subscriber since like 1942.
I'm making it sound like I didn't know, but I know that's what happened. The cast didn't know.
Yeah.
Caused a little bit of a riff.
They are talking about a reunion, though.
I'm sure, like, she is. Do you see her anywhere?
Actually, yeah, she's doing her own stuff, and she's making, you know, she's got,
is
like,
she
does like a cooking thing or whatever.
Oh, well, she's probably
and
rich.
She has like a line or something. I don't know what it is, but they are talking about that.
Okay. Trust me, she's free. All right. So we then move on to my pick, which is the most disappointing finale of all time. And we kind of talked about it. I don't want to beat it with a hammer, but let me set the stage for you, John.
Uh-huh.
So, loved Lost. Loved it. Watching it with my buddy Scott Clark. You've heard him on the Hollywood Outsider before. Former regular member. Now he's doing the Gaming Outsider. He's doing great things. He's on our Patreon. There's a cross plug, John. I'm trying to warm you up here a little bit. He's on the
right,
Patreon
right.
Game of Thrones special that you're going to hear a little later. sit in his house with their wives. You know, we're watching Lost. We've been watching the final season a lot together, and we're coming together to watch this finale because we are so excited to get all those answers. And I know during the season, boy, they gave you some answers to some of the island mysteries and a whole lot of, well, it's good versus evil. What? Anyway. And then the ending happened. Say what you want about the ending, however you want to take it. Here's how I took it. Scott Clark and I stood up. And I don't remember the exact how it all played out or anything else, but I remember looking at the TV in disbelief and looking at him, and looking back at the TV, and just going, oh, fuck you. And that's exactly how I feel about the Lost ending.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so moving right along to my most disappointing ending. And probably the ending that really did this, I had more or less the same reaction to, was the ending for How I Met Your Mother.
Oh.
Now, I've never watched this show, but I've heard this a lot from people, that it's a very disappointing ending.
Stupid.
Well, let's set up the show for you. The whole premise of the show is this guy is telling his teenage kids about the story in which he met their mother. And as the story continues, we hear about the fact that he has this group of friends, and they're a pretty amazing group of friends. There's a girl in that group of friends. He has a crush on her. They date. They don't date. They date. They don't date. She dates somebody else. She gets married to somebody else. It's this whole thing. And then finally, he meets their mother near the very last season of the show. And then they killed her.
What?
Yeah. The last episode, they straight up ganked her ass. Because there's no kind way of putting this, because this is really bullshit, because we just sat through so many years of this charming, fun story of how he met the mother. But what the story ultimately becomes is this guy asking for his children's permission to go bang one of his best friends instead of like pining away for their dead mother.
It is so dumb, this ending.
This sounds dumb. Is this why people are so mad, because she died or because he went off and he wants to bang somebody's friend?
It's the whole concept of you're going to build all of this up and you're going to make the show one thing and then you're going to end it being completely different. And it's right. Almost disrespectful. Well, this is how I took it. It was almost disrespectful to your audience members to do something this stupid. Did not feel well thought out.
Did you feel like the carpet was pulled out from under you?
It's especially when she died. Yeah, I was kind of like, because the whole time you're thinking to yourself, okay, well he's telling this story, but him and Robin are constantly dancing around each other in this tete-a-tete of relationships, and yeah, he's also dated other people throughout the life of the show, and some of them were better choices for him than Robin, so it was actually kind of interesting seeing that. And then we meet who ends up being his wife. She's actually an amazing character, because all the other characters love her, and then they, like, you know, they never actually fully get married either, which is another interesting aspect of the story. So they have the kids, they keep on putting off getting married, and then she dies.
Yeah, that sounds brutal as a fan. I can get. I know. Speaking of Scott Clark, I know he has come around to liking that ending, even though he hated it at first. But he's the only person I've ever heard say that. I know a lot of people that really just get mad talking about that show.
In support of Scott Clark, I have rewatched the show, and I've gotten over my irritation with it, with the exception of sometimes it hits a nerve, and I'm like, are you kidding me?
On the flip side, which one was your example of perfection? This is how you bring a series to an end, and what was that like as a fan for you?
So, I'm going to paint you a picture. My wife and I, my wife forced me to sit down and watch this little show because, well, she had started watching it and she started liking it. In our dating career, we started a relationship long distance. And so we would, yeah, it's a career, you know. It's,
okay.
I mean, there's an interview process, there's benefits, there's
good call.
Insurance that happens.
Sometimes you get fired. Yeah, I get it.
Right. Sometimes you get fired unexpectedly. Like, there's
every once in a while, I get a part-time job.
High deductibles.
I get it.
Right. So In our dating career, we'd actually watch this together long distance. I would go to Blockbuster and rent a disc of it, and we would sit on the phone and we would watch the same disc of Lost while she was in Georgia and I was down here in Florida. And this is how part of our relationship was built, was we would sit down and watch this sort of thing. And it was fun. And as time went on, I really just enjoyed building this relationship with this woman and having this show to share between the two of us. And this show just happened to have everything I kind of liked. It had great characters. It had mysteries. It had an island. It had people casually taking off clothing every now and again. I really like all this stuff.
Perfect for phone sex opportunities.
Whoa.
All right. She is my wife now. Have some respect.
I know. And I'm picturing it.
Me too.
That's awkward.
So we get to the ending, and the whole time in my head, as I'm watching this the last season come up, I'm wondering, how are they going to tie up everything for this show? And I was actually really worried about it, because what I didn't want to see was some cheesy sort of answer as to how all this stuff on this magical island had to happen. And guess what? They didn't bother. They didn't care. And I was like, bravo, because I didn't want them to try to come up with a reason as to why the things happened on the island as it did. And it ends on this note of people who were strangers becoming connected because of this island. The people who are becoming a family and moving on to the next adventure together. And it was just, to me, very beautiful and very entertaining. And that's why I love that ending.
And you know, because you picked it as your example of perfection, I won't pick it apart. See, you son of a bitch.
That was also like a really sweet story, too.
It was. Like, it touched. So, like, as much as I want to come back at it, and I could, and desecrate it, I won't, because it sounds like a very loving story of how a couple came together before they were lost, or with Lost. How do you work Lost in the
time? If it makes you feel any better, we also did the same thing with 24. So we did it with both Lost and 24.
Wow, you Thank guys God. Have a hot relationship.
I'm just
building.
Happy you got at least one good ending. That's
Did we though?
Yes, you did.
Did we?
You did. If you know,
he's married. He's had more than one.
There's a happy ending happening somewhere.
Anyway, that was weird and awkward. Okay, I'm gonna tell you about a show. My perfect example of a series ending is it's a show about a cowboy. It's a cowboy, and it was never horribly deep. It was never really thought-provoking, but it was always entertaining. Week in, week out, this is a show that just brought me joy. I just enjoyed watching it. It was fun to watch. And the last season, honestly, wasn't even great. It wasn't its best season. It was a good season, but it wasn't great. But the final aspect of the episode that ended it all nailed everything I had come to love about the show, and specifically the characters of Raylan Givens and Boyd Crowder. The last scene, the very last scene of the show, they do nothing more than have a simple conversation. He's a lawman on one side, Boyd's a criminal on the other side, and visiting him in jail. And the line comes up where he says, "We dug coal together," and it's absolute waterfalls. I've rewatched this episode 6 times. Cry every time. I don't cry.
What?
6 times. I've cried every time. Every single time. It, and the show is Justified, if you haven't figured it out by now, it's Justified, which is funny because it's not a show that inspires you to get overly emotional. It's just, it's more of a fun, he's a good old boy who likes to shoot criminals kind of show. I mean, he's just, Raylan, he's not a great guy. He's not a great cop. He's not really great at anything, but for whatever reason, he's fun as hell to watch and he's cool. And Boyd Crowder is a even cooler to watch, honestly. He's just entertaining. Walton Goggins is just something to behold in everything he does. But it's this last moment, this last conversation, where everything of the entire previous 6 seasons comes together and it makes sense. It's this powerful display of everything that everybody in the audience already knew, but we needed some confirmation on the screen because you never really get it on the screen. We finally got confirmation that they were friends on opposite sides of the law, but they were friends. As much as throughout the seasons, like one tried to kill the other one, or the other one tried to kill the other one, or they tried to put him in jail, or whatever they were trying to do, it never came to fruition because they were ultimately friends. And both of them finally acknowledged that they couldn't kill each other. because they dug coal together, because they were friends. And it doesn't, if you watch the show, it means so much more than probably hearing it, but it was such a powerful ending to a show that I never expected a powerful ending. So I was blown away, and I still, like I said, cry every time I watch it. Justified.
Very cool.
Look at you guys with your emotional attachments to your television shows.
It happens.
Rarely, hey, but
I had an emotional attachment to Lost, too, but it's just a little different than John. Amanda, what about you? What's your perfection?
So, on the other spectrum of Buffy came a spinoff called Angel.
Great ending.
Ooh.
So, I chose this because it did have the perfect ending, and I don't know of any controversy around this ending. Almost everybody that I know has said if they've seen it, they loved the ending for very good reason. The show was always about how evil is unconquerable for eternity, but you have to continue the fight no matter what. You have to keep trying that. You can never completely rid your life of that fight because evil will always exist in some form or another. But in the show, in this ending, they gave us enough closure to the storylines and leave just enough open for us to imagine what happened next. And normally I'm not somebody who's like, oh, you can leave this kind of open-ended for me. And I'm not normally fine with that because I like to know what's the final moment. You know, I need to see some people die. I need to see it all come to an end. But the last scene in this show in Angel was so perfect because I didn't need to know anymore. I knew that they were going to continue doing what they've always done. This was the perfect ending because it didn't take anything away from the story. My main character was still there. I still got to see him doing what he does best and see all of the growth from, you know, Buffy to this character that he's progressed through in Angel and all of the other characters and their relationships and all of the dynamics that have happened there. And I didn't have to have an answer to everything. And it was awesome. And they didn't make it so I wanted to know the answer to everything. They made such a perfect ending that you can walk away saying, I can imagine what happens next in my own head.
And they're having adventures. And I think the last line is, let's go to work, right? Something like that. Let's go to work. Oh, I love that ending.
So good.
He says, you take the ones on the left, you take the ones on the right. I'm going to slay the dragon.
Let's go to work.
Yeah.
So I still got it right.
No, you still got it right. But I really wanted to say that I'm going to slay the dragon line because that's my favorite part of that whole thing.
It is pretty great because it like came out of nowhere. Wait, there's a dragon?
I still have to say my favorite episode in that entire series is probably the one with the puppet.
Puppet.
Yes, yeah. It's so good.
Oh my God. You're a wee little puppet man. I mean, wait, what a great way for that show to finish out on top, because the as much as that show was great the first few seasons, when they started when Cordelia was messing around with Connor, it kind of got a little weird and hard to watch. And then when they are all of a sudden in charge of that law firm, it got a little convoluted.
Yeah.
But for them to suddenly like turn it around in those last few episodes when they said, nope, we have a direction, we're going to take this and we're going to go full steam ahead with this direction, hats off for them for doing that.
Agree.
We also posed this in our Facebook group like we always did. We asked the question, can TV series finales ever live up to your expectations? Overwhelmingly, the answer is yes. They have met or exceeded expectations. Very few felt like no shows ever have. So that's good news. And I'm going to kind of scroll down some of the shows that other people mentioned as sticking the landing. Peter Dennis said, You're the Worst is a recent example.
Oh.
I haven't seen that, but I've heard that's a great show. I haven't watched it. Josh Stima and Scott Cagaro both said The Shield are prime examples. And that is a great series ending, too, if you watch that show. Did you watch that one, John?
I did not.
Shield is a good show. If you guys can find it. Definitely watch it. I mean, it's a little long.
That was the FX show, right?
Mm-hmm. It's got Walton Goggins, too. So you can't go wrong with Walton Goggins ever. Nate Bruce said Breaking Bad, which I kind of thought would be one of ours, but it wasn't. But it is a great ending.
I was going to bring it up just because I so recently finished that series. But it wasn't the best of all time, but it did have a pretty significant ending. And it was another one of those kind of similar to Angel where you didn't need to have the answer to everything. You know, Jesse's left in that same, you know, picture it in your own mind sort of way.
Right. And Walter White gets an ending.
Yeah.
Of sorts. Laura Eckhart, Parks and Rec, did a great job.
Yes.
Yep, they totally did.
Mac Herring, he said, Good Times. Well, that's a really good mention, by the way. Good for you. That was a really memorable ending. The other, he said Fringe as well.
Yep.
Leslie Plunkett, Sopranos and Mad Men finales were okay, but Sex and the City, though it was pretty clear set up for a movie down the road, was pretty good. 6 Feet Under, Laura Butler. That's interesting.
That is a pretty popular pick.
Yeah. Troy Heinrichs, friend of the show. Fringe, Alias, Sopranos, Family Ties, Continuum are examples of that.
Wait, are the rest of them not friends of the show? Did you have to isolate Troy as being a friend of the show?
Because we mentioned him earlier. Everybody that I'm mentioning is a friend of the show. Welcome aboard. Elaine Newman, 6 Feet Under and Parenthood had great finales. Ty Nelson, Freaks and Geeks, 6 Feet Under, and Star Wars Rebels.
Oh.
I didn't watch it. I don't watch cartoons. I'm too busy being a man.
That's a cartoon I never got around to watching and for some reason, but I've heard nothing but great things from people that I trust.
Okay, well, you trust that. Amy Peterson says One Tree Hill.
Oh, yes.
She loves the One Tree Hill finale.
That's good.
That's good. A lot of people said Breaking Bad. Manuel Perez, he echoes One Tree Hill and Home Improvement. Huh. Sean McGuire, Justified ended perfect. Yeah, shout out to Sean. You get it. And then a bunch of, basically the rest of them are kind of variations of the same thing. Oh, Brian Lowry loved Angel and Psych.
Oh,
which I don't know. Do I count that anymore? Because technically it came back. So does it count as a finale if they come back?
It still had a finale. You know, when they created that, they didn't know they were going to have a movie. It's not like they had that set up.
And that was a pretty perfect ending for Psych.
It was. That Lasseter moment, I cry at that too. The Lasseter moment where he watches the video and Sean's finally going to tell him everything he wanted to know, and he turns the tape off because it doesn't matter anymore.
I forgot about that.
Yep.
Way to make me tear up a little.
Also, Val Kilmer.
Yes.
I've never talked to these people.
That was pretty cool that Val Kilmer popped up. And everybody's like, wait, Val Kilmer was in Psych? Yes, he was. He was. Okay, now we're going to go ahead and skip to our Patreon exclusive content for Game of Thrones premiere discussion. We're going to do that right now. But I want to say next week is our summer movie preview episode. We're going to talk about all the movies coming out in summer 2019. But now, this is your Temptation Island. Yeah, this is your tease. You get the whole episode, but this is your tease for a future series that John started, basically half hour, power hour?
It is the Hollywood Outsider Half Hour Power Hour, a name so ridiculous that I love it.
Okay, whatever works.
A name so ridiculous, only Johnny could come up with it.
Basically, it's going to be a half hour, but somehow ended up being 45 minutes. where they talk about Game of Thrones, the season premiere, in spoilers. So there's a lot of spoilers here, so be wary if you haven't watched it yet. And then if you want to continue to listen to this, as well as a lot of other stuff, like there's a lot of extra bonus stuff that we have in Patreon, go to patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider and sign up for the, I believe it's $3 or more tier.
Yes. Yeah.
A month.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember, the next time you head to a theater, buy some popcorn. But here is Game of Thrones.
This is the Hollywood Outsider Half Hour Power Hour. It's going to be a Patreon exclusive show for you, our amazing listeners who spend time with us here on Patreon. We're going to be doing this new project in seasons. Each season we'll be focusing on a single show that's currently airing or something to rewatch. We'll probably do that for giggles. Who knows? We'll be covering a show week by week, episode by episode, an easy to digest half hour broadcast. Keep in mind, these episodes are going to be weapons free and spoilers-tastic. This season, we're covering Game of Thrones. This episode, we're on season 8, episode 1, Winterfell. I, in the craziest position ever, and in a weird turn of events, am going to be your host. I am R. John Davenport. And joining me today are my fellow hosts. From Ho Mothership, from Smirk, and Veronica's Marshmallows, we have Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
And also a Ho Mothership veteran, we have the Grand Pooba of the Gaming Outsider podcast, Scotty Clark.
What is happening, Mr. Davenport?
I don't know. What do you think about the intro? Was that too much? Was it just right? What do you think?
I think it was perfect, man.
That was pretty good, especially your reading. Like,
yeah.
I was a little worried when I realized you were going to read the format, but you did great.
Yeah. You know what? Sometimes I can get it right. I'm kind of like a broken clock that way. All right, so let's start off like this, because it was August 2017 was the last time we had a good old-fashioned, brand new to everyone Game of Thrones episode. And here we are. It is April 2019, and I mean, what kind of show would actually put like nearly 20 months wait on their fans and really expect us to come back? I mean, can you think of any other show can do that?
Lost probably could have back in the day. People would have probably waited for that. But other than that, I don't really know many shows, especially these days, that people would be willing to wait it out and see what the finale is going to be that long.
Yeah, that's really the only one I can think of as well. Although some of the other shows that I've watched, it felt like I was waiting 20 months for it because I wanted to see it so badly. I know The Leftovers was one that I could not wait to see how it ended. And but yeah, that's a long way. But here's the thing. 20 months, it didn't feel like 20 months. I don't know how to describe it because we sat down with our group. Amanda, you're part of that group, to watch this last night. And we sat there and did the math. Like it's been almost 2 years since we sat in this room and watched the last episode, the finale. And it does not seem like that long. It really feels like it's just been the 1 year, but it hasn't.
I thought somebody was lying to me. I was like, it has not been 2 years. We were just here last year. Get your math together. And nope, I was wrong.
You know, that's a really great testament to how fantastic this show is, because it is something that seems to stick with you. Like a lot of people I know were doing this thing where they're rewatching every single episode again.
Me.
And yeah, well, and though I feel like if I did that, I would have been able to pick up on some things that I think are pretty amazing now. I don't feel like it's necessary either, because like it's still so very fresh in my mind. So it's very cool. I can only think of maybe Sherlock does that, where it's very long in between seasons. Doctor Who sometimes does that, but those shows are a completely different kind of format. The only other one that comes to mind is possibly Westworld, but Westworld, like even the long wait for Westworld really kind of put me in a sour position. So I can't think of it much else.
You make a good point though about Westworld, because coming back to that one, I wasn't as amped as I was watching the first season. And I don't know if it has to do with the quality or if it's just I didn't rewatch the first season again. I didn't really feel like I needed to or want to. There's something about the depth and density of Game of Thrones that makes it, for a person like me who does rewatch it, it's just immensely enjoyable to rewatch it because of little things I pick up on.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, too, because the show has so much that we want to know about that we're not going to find anywhere else. And I think what really benefits them is that the books aren't finished. So if people want some sort of finality with Game of Thrones, they're going to have to watch the show to see what's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah, that's a crazy point, because the books aren't finished. And like I gotta George R. R. Martin sitting in his chair, like, why do I bother now?
Well, and he's a little bit aggressive with this new season, because he's like, this should not be the last season of Game of Thrones. I mean, they really need to have more time to finish things out. And I'm like, dude, you're how many books behind are you? At least they're getting stuff done.
Well, he's probably got some sort of health insurance thing that he's got to pay for or something. Or he wants to make sure he has money for.
He just wants to make more money, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure with the new show that's coming, so the prequel show that's going to be taking place thousands of years before this whole thing happens, which will probably, like, you know, in a weird way, I would expect that to be something where we have cavemen, but I guess in this world, it's not going to be cavemen. It'll probably still feel like the same time and same world. They have that going for them, I guess.
I think they're just going to go by name alone, honestly. I mean, you got to admit that you're at least a little bit curious about what happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
Because how far back have we gone in the show? We went back when Ned was younger, and that's about as far back as we've seen, right?
Well, they did cover some of the stuff from when the forest people were out there.
Yeah, when they created the White Walkers.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the benefit of the new show, we'll probably be jumping directly into something that has magic and dragons and all that other junk.
Yeah, because we're already prepared for it.
Right.
That was kind of the beauty of this series, was that they didn't inundate you with it at the very beginning and kind of eased you into it. But now that everybody's used to it, go for it.
Right.
Well, and it's all not right. Like we've been oversaturated with what has been in the past either, you know, long before what our timeline is on for the show. So it's not like we have all of this flashback and information. They still have so much that they can build with that history that people would be surprised by.
Yeah. On that note, let's go ahead and kick off into the episode, okay?
Okay.
So First, John and Danny make it to Winterfell in a procession that seems that they're only missing a big blue genie singing and dancing and impersonating pop culture icons.
Prince
Sansa shows us. Sansa shows us that sometimes it's not just resting bitch face, and for good measure, she puts Tyrion in his place. Bran reminds everyone that they really need to stop fighting over who loves who more, and that White Walkers are definitely on their way because they've broken through the wall. And Arya has tender, loving moments with people that she has left behind, except for the one she left for dead. Okay, that was the first part of this episode. Like, how did that really strike you guys?
A lot happened, and I want to start at the beginning, because I think one of the cool things about this episode were the numerous parallels that there were to the very first episode.
Oh, yeah.
Season 1, Episode 1.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned at the top that, you know, this procession of them coming in. And I thought it was a beautiful moment because even though it wasn't the opening scene in episode one, you had the Lannisters coming into Winterfell in procession and everyone was greeting them. And back then, Arya was the kid that was struggling to watch them come in. And this whole episode starts with an unnamed kid that's trying to peer in and climb a tree to see everything. And Arya is the one that makes room for him because she's been there. And she knows what it's like, and she's got this grin on her face. I thought that was just a really great way to open the show that I wasn't expecting. I had my own thoughts about what was going to happen in the opening sequence, but I really liked it. And that was only the first of many. They kind of bookended the front and the end of the episode with glimpses back to the pilot.
Oh my God! Yeah, we're gonna hold off on that one.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that other one hit me today when I was thinking about it, and it just floored me. Mm-hmm. What do you got, Amanda?
I am with Scott in that I loved that they created those parallels, but it not only because we're like, oh, this takes us back to the first season. We're seeing how much growth that these characters have gone through, where Arya is no longer the one who is very... I feel like she wasn't necessarily extroverted, but she was the one who was always being adventurous and trying to snoop around and figure everything out. And now we have her just standing idle through this procession, and just she gets it and she's grown so much. And we see that with her family, that they've grown so much, like Jon Snow has grown so much. But at the same time, we still know that they're still the same people, and they've become much funnier in this episode. And I loved that where Sansa's like, oh, she's just lurking around somewhere.
I love that you mentioned the character growth, because I actually had that down in my notes as well. I mean, these characters, the kids have literally grown. They're much bigger than they were in the first season, but they've grown as people as well. I mean, I think as much as the kid annoys me, Bran has grown.
Holy crap. He doesn't even look like the same person.
He can actually double for Hodor at this point.
Well, the more he grows out his hair like the Beatles, he looks like a maester, even though I know that's not what he is. He's the three-eyed raven or whatever, but he looks like he belongs in chains, and you know, it looks like he's old already. But the fact that early on in this episode, he's the one that's telling everyone to put aside any differences and deal with what's important. He's voice of reason.
He is such like a mood killer too at the same time, because everybody's like having this really warm greeting, and then you've got some great Sansa and Daenerys like resting bitch face looks at each other, and they've got these snide, well, it's more so Sansa than it is Daenerys, but you have all this going on, and Bran just like jumps in and he's like, okay, that's enough. I know you guys are having a great reunion and meeting each other, but we have more important things to worry about, family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm the three-eyed raven.
No, there's one other thing that has grown as well, and you could almost call it a character, but the intro where they play the theme music and everything.
Yeah, that intro, like as soon as the graphics were different, I sat up. I couldn't believe they changed the entire way that the graphics were working. You saw the wall was down. Like,
wasn't that sad?
Yeah. The passage that the White Walkers was taking was like turning blue on its own. You saw each tile flip, and the idea that it went deep inside of Winterfell, and then it went deep inside of
the crypt,
King's Landing.
Yeah, crypt.
Instead of it being like above everything and watching everything from top, watching it from below, that was just really cool. I really liked how they handled it, and the fact that the emblem for Game of Thrones was kind of blackened like mm-hmm. that. Everything like the gold wash on everything was gone, and it was just like, you know, we're at the end.
Yeah, they were definitely symbolizing. This is it. This is the last time we're going to have a Game of Thrones season premiere. Like, we're not going to have this anymore. We're not even going to have a lot of these characters surviving by the time we get through these episodes. And so much has changed. And this is them foreshadowing, like, also going back and saying, okay, we're at a completely different point than we were when we started, but we're going to be at a completely different point when we end, too.
Yeah, we talked a lot about character changes, and the one that strikes me the most is definitely Sansa, because like Sansa went from being this sweet girl who just wanted to be a pretty girl and have fun and be married to royalty to now she has no time for anyone's crap whatsoever. She doesn't care who you are, what's going on. You know, Tyrion walks up, hey, we were married, we know, we love it, da, 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 da. Yeah. And then she's just like, you're stupid. You're stupid if you believe anything that woman says. And she has no problem calling out these characters for their crap. And it's just so beautiful to watch her stand from that position of power.
But she also does it tactfully and gracefully, like when she's in the Great Hall or whatever they call it in Winterfell, and she's actually accepting of the queen. She calls her Your Grace.
Oh, she didn't do that. That was pretty slighted, though. I didn't feel like she really meant, like, she's going to abide, but I don't really think that she was like, oh, you're welcome here, Your Grace.
Well, I mean, she doesn't really have much of a choice. I mean, she's, you know, what's she going to do? This is the queen that if she doesn't do what she's told, then there's going to be a real problem.
Well, I think that she's already, by her having those conversations with John, that's her way of being tactful and manipulative, like she's learned from Cersei, to be like, I don't want her to be my queen. I'll respect her for what she is right now as much as I have to, but she wants her gone, and she's trying to convince John of the reason why, not necessarily have her gone, but just not as queen. She wants to see John on the throne, and she's saying that he needs to be the king, and she reiterates that to him numerous times. So I don't feel like she's very accepting whatsoever.
Well, I mean, even Daenerys said herself, your sister doesn't like me. She gets that. But the thing that annoyed me so much in this episode was when Sansa asked the question. She looked him straight in the eye and said, why did you bend the knee? Did you do it to save the North, or did you do it because you love her? And then they just fade to another scene. What is his answer? Because I don't, at this point, us as the audience, I don't think we know.
Well, I think we do know, because if you remember the last episode, that's when she lost the dragon. That's when she risked her life and the dragon's life to come get them. And he did all these things to take care of, he ran that mission to get the White Walker to show to Cersei what's going on with the White Walkers, that, and it was all his crazy idea and she risked everything for him, that he had to do something for her in return.
Well, and to foreshadow something we are going to talk about in the next part, but there's the question around Daenerys of, would she make the same sacrifices that Jon has been willing to make in the past and always would make? And to what John was just talking about, absolutely, I think Daenerys would, as long as it's something that she believes in and somebody that she, you know, cares about, or if she does think that it's ultimately for the right thing. She's starting to learn that she wasn't always the best queen. She wasn't always the best ruler. She didn't always make the best decisions. She was very impulsive, but it seems like she's growing. Like, we've seen Sansa grow, and she made a lot of stupid decisions. A lot of them. But now she's to the point where we're like, you know, she's grown and she's understood that she's made mistakes and she's a different person from it. I think Daenerys is getting there too, and would be willing to make the sacrifices if necessary.
All right. So on that note, let's go ahead and move on to the second half of this episode. Euron brings the Golden Company to King's Landing, and somehow Cersei is doing her best Veruca Salt impression and complains that she didn't get elephants.
Jesus.
Euron decides that he's been a good boy and deserves a treat, so Cersei obliges him by turning her body into a clown car. Davos, Varys, and Tyrion are plotting a wedding because, hey, those are always going over well in this world.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, Dany gives Jon another ride, only this time on a dragon. Tormund and Beric meet up with the rest of the Night's Watch at a devastated Last Hearth castle. Samwell is peer pressured into telling Jon about his past, and somehow Jon misses the point by only focusing on the fact that his dad lied to him, and not the fact that he's banging his aunt.
He doesn't even focus on that. He focuses on that Ned lied to him.
Right.
It's his way of, it's a defense mechanism sort of thing for him, because he doesn't want to admit to himself that this is the truth. He's trying to find different holes. He's trying to poke holes in this of, I'm going to focus on something else.
He's trying to poke holes in something else.
And feeling all right about it. You know, it's interesting, but so here's something that a parallel to, I think, the first or second episode that didn't strike me until later on today, which is, if you guys remember, when Ned and John were traveling and Ned was going to King's Landing and John was going to Castle Black, there's that point of the crossroads where Ned says to John, he says, when the next time we see each other, I'm going to tell you about your mother.
Mm. Right.
Ned finds out about who his mother and father actually are while he is at Ned's little shrine.
Who and finds totally out?
I think you meant John finds out.
Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry, you're right. John finds out who his parents are when he's standing at Ned's shrine.
Yeah, so the next time they met is when he found out about his mother.
Yeah. So it didn't strike me when I was watching the episode, but when I was reflecting on it, I thought that was well done. So cool.
I didn't just notice that enough until just now. So thanks for the info.
Very subtle, but I liked it.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. I like how they handled that for sure. And Cersei, like, she's pulling the complete, like, it's interesting watching Cersei and Sansa back to back like this, because Sansa is so much like the complete opposite of Cersei at this point, where sure, she's kind of plotty and sure, she's kind of bitch facey, but she knows what she's doing now. And it seems like she's actually doing things to protect her family. Whereas Cersei has been saying this entire time that everything she does is for her family. But the sheer fact that of everything she does in the second half kind of points in the direction of, no, there is no family protection for her. It's just her.
Okay, well, here's what I want to talk about, because in the last season, she tells Jamie, I believe manipulatively it was a lie, that she was pregnant. And then she uses it with Tyrion and says, she holds her belly, obviously. Like, who holds their belly unless they're on their period or they're pregnant? She's obviously pregnant. And so Tyrion's like, oh, she's pregnant. And then we have no idea what the rest of their conversation was, but then she decides to come to terms with it. Now, my theory is, and you guys tell me what you guys think, I guess I have two. Either she was not pregnant when she told Jaime that and Tyrion that, but she knew that it would get the sympathy of her brothers and it would allow her to manipulate them even further, but then saw the opportunity with Euron, like, oh, I can actually get pregnant here and then it won't be a lie this whole time and I will have protection because my family will want to keep me safe if they know I'm pregnant. Or maybe she really was pregnant. I don't know. I really don't think she was pregnant.
Did you almost Detective Pikachu this?
Pretty close. There's one tiny little clue that may or may not be a clue, but while she's in her chambers with Euron, you'll notice that she is drinking wine.
Yep.
And, you know, this is Westeros. This isn't nowadays, so do they know about fetal alcohol syndrome? Is that even a thing? However, I'm going to go on the assumption that they know that drinking when you're pregnant is bad. And if that's the case, would she drink while she were pregnant with child? Part of me says no, because she actually does love her family more
than
anything
else. That's the only thing she cares about are her kids.
And that's one thing Tyrion told her. It's like her greatest quality is that she loves her kids. And she's lost them. And
well, she didn't drink in the episode with Tyrion.
Okay.
Season 7, she didn't drink with Tyrion. So he poured himself a drink and then he went to pour her a drink and she did not drink that episode.
Well, but she also knows that Tyrion is more clever than Euron in that regard.
Right, right.
And that could have been a test from Tyrion to see if she really was pregnant, because he knows that she wouldn't drink it. But now that she's around Euron, it's a different story.
Well, and that's an opportunity for her to establish more loyalty to somebody else like my other thing is, okay, maybe she really did get pregnant by Jaime and her way of covering it up is to sleep with somebody else. And then it would be like, oh, well, he was my babe daddy. So
doesn't everybody know that Jaime and
they've known like this entire show, but yet they continue to try to hide it and pretend like it doesn't exist. And it's like, dude, everybody knows that you bang your brother. Like everybody.
Yeah, not last season. She was out and proud about that last season.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought was interesting is the point where her hand, I forget her hand's name, but he comes in the room and tells Bronn that, you know, hey, you're going to get paid if you go kill both Tyrion and Jaime. Mm-hmm. So like she's out to go ahead and finally kill Jaime and not care. And like if you really think about this entire show, which was the second there was a problem with Jaime, Cersei was off to the next warm body to keep her warm in bed. Whereas Jaime, on the other hand, we only ever seen him with Cersei.
That dude needs to get laid. Is that what the moral of this topic right here is?
Well, he can't take care of himself.
He's got another hand.
Yeah, it doesn't work as well.
You're right.
It doesn't apply to this.
No. I don't really think that she took Euron to bed just for another warm body. Because if that was her only motivation for that, then she would have done it in secret and not in front of the council.
Well, and she wouldn't have waited, because if you notice, well, I mean, obviously everybody knows, she's like, if you want a whore, buy one. If you want a queen, earn her. And then she starts to walk away, and she obviously has a moment where she's like on her walk. She's thought about it, and there's something that clicks for her. Cersei does not usually make impulsive decisions that doesn't have some sort of a long-term benefit or manipulation tactic embedded into it. So her walking away and then just changing her mind within a minute and a half to have sex with Euron after she just told him this like whole really cool thing where she's like, if you want a queen, earn her. And then she's like, oh, never mind. You can come into bed with me. Like, let's do this.
I think a lot of that is that she genuinely is attracted to him to some level too. She flat out told him that he's the most arrogant man she's ever met. And she likes it. So is that her feeding him a line of bull to stroke his ego? To put her have him in her back pocket? Or does she?
It could be a combination of both.
Well, I could see her trying to put him in her back pocket, but I don't think she understands the level in which he is a wild card, because he really is a wild card. He's only doing this because he makes his wants and needs very clear to Yara before he goes into this whole meeting. And he's only there really to like for a notch on his bedpost to get some power and get all this. And the second that she can't offer him power, the second that she can't offer him anything, I tell you, he's going to bolt. He is going to bolt out of there so fast.
Speaking of people sleeping with other people, does anyone feel like this sexual tension between Arya and Gendry? Anyway, between the two of them needs to just be like sliced. They need to just get it on. Did anyone else feel that?
I think
that?
She'll break him in half.
Ooh, he might break her. You don't know. Let this happen.
He's bigger than she is.
That's why Hopefully. She will definitely break him in half.
Yeah, there definitely seemed to be more chemistry there. And that brings me to my next question, actually, because the scene when he's making weapons, because they're making weapons out of dragon stone?
Dragon glass,
thank you. Wow, I'm an awesome fan. She hands him a piece of paper and says, can you build this? And I tried, because I watched this episode twice, and I could not make out what the hell she wants to make him. I know it's some kind of sword, because he said, you already have a sword, or I'm assuming, but what is it that she wants him to make? I could not really gather it. Could you?
It looked like something that has a launching apparatus to it. Like right. the there are two parts come apart on it. So it seems to me like it's something to be launched.
Yeah, I wasn't able to really decipher her drawing either, but it was obviously some sort of a weapon. It just doesn't seem to be like a normal, regular sword. But I have no idea what her intentions with this device are either, who she plans on using it against.
Yeah, I mean, she wants to kill Cersei. Cersei's on her list.
Who doesn't want to kill Cersei?
Well, but that also brings up another point, because she had her list for all this time, and everybody on her list is dead except for Cersei and the Hound, who she runs into in this room as well, which was one of the most interesting reunions from this episode, because there was a lot of them. It could have gone ugly there for a second. I want to know if you guys feel like I do, because as much hatred as there was between the Hound and Arya, I feel like there's a little bit of mutual respect as well, especially from the Hound.
Oh, yeah. I definitely saw like the Hound kind of gave her a tip of the hat, you know, a wag of the finger about how she was able to survive on her own being such a little girl.
Right.
And he saw her at the lowest points in her life, and he can only imagine what she had to get through to get back to Winterfell at that point, and to even be to hold herself in a statue that or a stature that doesn't really fear him or shy away from him. She stares him dead in the face, which she was always really good at that, but this time there's absolutely no flinching.
Right.
So I'm sure there's a little bit of like, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy, whereas you think she wants him dead, and you think he is very proud of who she has become. It's interesting.
I agree. And I just really love that moment. And I think that the way that he more or less told her off in a very vulgar fashion right before he walked away.
Oh, that she's like a cold little bitch.
Right. That is a term of endearment.
It is, yeah.
For him.
Because he didn't use the C word. And no. If he doesn't use the C word, then he likes you.
Yeah.
Well, and they went through quite a bit together, and it was pretty clear that he has a respect for her. Because no matter what Arya has gone through, she always holds to her beliefs, and she's going to do what she wants to do. And if anybody gets in her way, she's going to slice them. And that's kind of how he lives his life. He's like, if you get in my way, you're dead. I'm going to continue on whatever my mission might be, and I'm going to see it through. Nobody's going to stop me. And Arya is the same way. And she stood up to him. Like, she was not, there were times obviously where she was scared of him, but after time, like, she had no problem trying to escape from him or do whatever she wanted to do, say whatever she wanted to say, and call it a day. And I think that ultimately created some level of respect from the Hound for Arya.
I think there was a bit of a fatherly aspect, too.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit. Yeah. So let's cover one last thing, which is Dany and Jon kind of riding off into the Never Never Land on the back of the dragons.
I can show you the world.
Right?
He actually did do that, if anybody's wondering when it happened.
That's totally what I thought of.
So there's a part of this that I absolutely adore, which is the point in which they land, they're about to snuggle up to each other, there's about to be a kiss, and he looks over at the dragon, and the dragon is staring him dead in the face. The reason why that resounds so much with me is that I have two brand new puppies. That one's a year and 8 months, the other one's 9 months. The second I hug my wife, the two of them want to get in between us so fast, and they're so jealous. And that's what that scene kind of reminded me of. I'm like, I can barely get close to my wife without these dogs getting in my way. I can't imagine why this dragon hasn't torn the two of these two apart.
Well, yeah, well, you can't just like screw their mom right in front of them. Like, they were getting a little bit like sexy there for a second. She's like, you keep your queen warm. And he was like,
she was the instigator. Come on.
Yeah.
I think we're glossing over a pretty big point, though.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, bring it up. Come on. I'm ready for it.
I can't tell if you're being facetious or not.
No, I'm being serious. I know exactly where you're going
to
go.
The fact that John is able to ride the dragon, and he has not yet put it together that he's Targaryen, because only Targaryens can ride a dragon. And the fact that these dragons, I'm actually pissed at myself that I didn't think of this last season before we found out that the dragons, you know, let him pet them on the nose or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very symbolic that he's able to ride the dragon, and the fact that neither of them acknowledge that is disturbing to me.
Well,
that
think be... they're gonna.
Well,
they're gonna have to. Yeah, I mean, they're gonna be told, but at the same time, they're gonna have him stroking a dragon, being like, "See, like the only people who can do that are you people. That's it. Like the Targaryens can do that, you morons."
And Tyrion, if we go back, he was actually able to tame the dragons, which makes me think that he has some Targaryen in him too, and that could be another reason why his father was always such a jackass to him.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you remember that? It was a long time ago, but...
He was able to take the chains off of them.
Yeah. I don't think he was taming them.
But it was enough where they let him get close enough to them. They would not let anybody get close enough to them. They will eat your face off. And they... No. Of course, they were very aggressive. But we've even seen the aggression shown towards Jon, and I don't think that Tyrion by any means is like a full-blood Targaryen, but it makes me believe that if they're keeping all of this from the books true in the show, then there's some sort of an indication that there's a potential that he has Targaryen in him as well.
I think if Tyrion were had any Targaryen in him and came out as a dwarf, Tywin would have had him killed. Because he talked about doing it at the very beginning, and that was when we thought he was a full-fledged Lannister. If he weren't a full-fledged Lannister and came out that way, there's no way he would have lived.
Well, maybe he doesn't. Right. Maybe he doesn't know. I mean, it's possible. It's possible that she could have just been like,
"I can't get behind it. There's no way."
I don't blame you for not being able to get behind it, because that would actually muddy the waters of the story so late in the game. It would really muddy up the waters of the story this late in the game. So, because a lot of what they're supposed to be doing is bringing everything to a head. It's supposed to be coming to a point, and to do something. And because a couple of seasons ago they had him touch the dragons on the chains and unchain those dragons, but they haven't shown anything since where the dragons have been able to interact with him. So. Yeah, that'd be kind of a red herring or just a way to distract us and or muddy the waters so far in the game. So that's why I can't get behind it either.
Well, and I'm fine with it not being a legitimate thing, but my point to that would just be they haven't stayed true to their rules, because nobody should even be able to touch the dragons unless they have that in them. But how then do we explain Tyrion? And so I guess that's my thing, is just there's some muddying that's already happened with these rules that have been established from the books and weren't necessarily established in the show. But,
all Tyrion did was unchain them, right?
Yeah, that's all he did.
He never touched them. And he was very cautious about it. And they thought about having him for a snack.
Right. Oh, speaking of which, what is it the dragons eat?
Whatever
they want.
All right. So.
We have one thing left that has to be talked about, though.
Do we?
Samwell talking to John and like him finding out about Danny killing his family. I feel like that was a big turning point for his character, because now he's like he's got anger and he has a reason for it, and he didn't have that before.
Man, the way that he delivered that performance when she told him that his brother and his father were killed at her hand. There was so many emotions going on in that 5 minute scene. The look on his face, I just 100% believed every emotion he had going on.
Yeah, he was. It's a tough scene, because if you remember, like, the scene starts off where she's thanking him for bringing Lord Friendzone back to her. And like, it's a happy moment. He's all proud of himself. He's feeling really good. And he, like, I'm okay, great. I'm going to get pardoned. I'm going to get this. I'm going to that. Awesome. I really like this. You did what now? Oh, my pretty dad? Weird. Okay. Well, he's kind of a jerk, but that's fine. I can go back to hang out with my brother. I really like him. Oh, you him too? So.
How do you guys feel about when he does tell John and he's having that conversation with him? And he's like, she didn't tell you about this? There's like quite a bit of assumption that she knows a lot about their friendship, and it's not like she knows who Sam was before. She's just now finding out who he is. Why would he think that she would just tell him about everybody she kills and it being Sam's family?
Well, I mean, what other pillow talk is there? So I went to Charlie's today. And this guy's name is Dickon. Would you believe that? Come on. What kind of name is that?
Good point. No, there are some people who are like legitimately concerned about that. And I'm personally fine with it, because I would assume that my best friend would tell their girlfriend about me. Like, come on, I'm your best friend, dude. But
yeah, I understand where everyone's coming from, but to our knowledge, the character we know of Samwell has been nothing more than honest and actually fair and honorable to John. He has protected John. He's brought John back. He has done everything he can to look out for John. And this, I don't think he's going to do anything different than that. And for him to suddenly right turn and become something more like his father would be hard to actually watch. Is it possible? Sure. And would it make the character a million times more interesting to see him take that right turn? Yeah, sure. But he is such a loved character just because of how pure he always seemed to be and how much he's willing to take care of those people around him and get past his own feelings, that for him to suddenly take that turn, it would be abrupt and weird. But hey, maybe it will help and make him a better character.
Yeah, I think I'm almost more intrigued by what they're going to do with Sam than most at this point, because there's such a brew going on, or a pressure cooker going on between everybody at Winterfell, because you've got a lot of strangers in there. The North don't like outsiders. You got a lot of people there that named John the King. He basically gave up his crown to go bang this Targaryen. They're not happy with him. Are they on the precipice of revolting and turning against him? And is that going to cause something to happen? Man, it's crazy to me that it's more tense in Winterfell than it is at King's Landing.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that is weird.
And now we have Jaime and Bran seeing each other face to face, and that's how the episode concludes. And I'm like, oh, my God, dude's been chilling out here for like 2 days waiting for you.
Yeah, because you had no
waiting,
idea. When
waiting for an old friend.
Yeah.
I didn't catch that.
By the way, that was the bookend moment that I was referring to, John, because.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Because, well, for those that don't know where I'm going with this, the first episode ended with Jaime pushing Bran out of that tower. And that is the last time those two characters saw each other.
Oh my gosh.
And then they ended it with the two of them looking. And the look on Jaime's face was, I don't know if I've awkward. Seen that look on his face. Well, it was more than awkward. It was, he had fear in his eyes.
He did. He absolutely did. And we don't see that in his character hardly ever. I don't know that I can think of many times where Jaime has just looked at another person who doesn't, he doesn't have a weapon in his hand. It's not like he can slice his other arm off right now, but he looks terrified.
Yeah,
he really does. Because we've had this argument before, especially with Aaron, who believes that there's no redemption for Jaime no matter what he does. But he has come around to a lot of people, a lot of fans of the show. He is a different person than he was. We talk about how these characters have growth. Jamie's had some growth. He's turned on Cersei quite a bit. Yeah, he's still been banging her. That's gross.
But, he's a horny dude, man.
Yeah. Well, and he does love Cersei.
He does.
I'm not saying that makes it right, but it's not like he's doing it just for being horny. So I'm really intrigued to see how that conversation goes. And I really hope they don't just go in and then all of a sudden they're in the Great Hall having a conversation. I want to see the first words that come out of either one of their mouths in the next episode.
Oh,
if that doesn't happen, I'm going to be really, really upset, because I need to know what those words are going to be.
There are characters who can be redeemed, and I know I can't argue with Aaron right now, which would be great if I could, but I personally have come around to Theon. Especially in this episode where he has now, with his sister, he's like, okay, you're my queen. I'm going to do what you want me to do, even if it's not. And he goes out to save her. And the look in his eyes, like, he is a different person to me. And he's harder for me to give any redemption to than Jaime. Like, okay, Jaime pushed a kid out the window. I'm like, well, I mean, that sucks, but the kid lived. But Theon,
just glossing over. Oh, yeah, you're also on the side of pro Daenerys and John banging too, so that throws every credibility that you have out the window.
What?
We had this conversation in our spoiler cast for season 7. You know, it's all okay. Right. Incest is okay if the characters are pretty enough.
Look, I'm not here to judge. That was fairly, well, I guess this is not like real modern times, but incest has been accepted long, long ago. It was part of the norm. The only reason it got away from it was because of the people who became really deformed, their children. But
John, do you hear her justifying it?
Danny says she can't even get pregnant now. And John and Danny are a cute couple. So, I mean, it's awkward, but it is what it is.
On that note, I'm going to do something that I didn't have planned. And I think we should actually do this. We're going to go ahead and give this episode a letter grade. So, Scott, if you were to give this a letter grade, what would you give it?
I would give it an A-.
You'd give it an A-.
A-. I think, and not that I expected it, but I feel like almost every episode in season 7 was feeling like a payoff. And we talked about that before, where the pacing of that show, there was something massively interesting happening every episode. But I'm not going to drop it lower than an A-, because even though not a lot of just mind-blowing things happened, nobody died, which was a shock, except for the kid on the wall. But it was a great season opener. It was a great way to set up the season. My only concern at this point is we only have 5 episodes left. Last year we had 7 more to go. There's only 5 episodes left in the entire series. But anyway, back to my point. A minus because it was very solid. I just was waiting for some more holy shit moments. If that makes
all right,
sense.
Amanda?
I'm going to give it a B plus. I think it could have been stronger as an opening. They could have had more to it than just a lot of reunions, because I felt like they slammed all of the reunions into this episode just to get it out of the way. And I think that could have been a little bit smoother if they would have somehow integrated that into the end of last season or something, or kind of float it more progressively in this first 1 or 2 episodes of the season. And they really need to. I mean, the whole dragon thing with John, I personally liked the way they did that and that romance, but they still need to, they didn't need to be back to back. Felt like those two scenes were almost back to back.
Okay. I'm going to also give it a B plus. And the reason why I'm going to give it a B plus is because and mind you, this episode is very strong and very great and has so many great things going for it. But I see the potential for there to be some mind blowing and amazing things. And I can't give everything an A or an A minus or anything. So something has to get a B. It's going to have to be this episode.
That's fair.
All right.
All right, guys, that's it. This is what we have planned. This is how these half hour power hours are supposed to go. I want to thank Amanda and Scott for joining me, guys.
Thanks for putting this together, man. This was all Johnny. Yeah. This was his idea. He created it. He set it up. He's helming it. If the editing sucks, that's his fault. It's been good.
Yep. I want to thank you very much. And moving on down the road, we'll see you next week. Thank you so much.